When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look at the screen. William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself. Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mindhunter. This is a Manhunter podcast from One Heat Minute Productions, unpacking and exploring and poring over all of the evidence from Michael Mann's 1986 adaptation of Thomas Harris's Red Dragon, Manhunter. Funnily enough, named Manhunter not because of Michael Mann or because of Criminal Profilers, because of the stink on a Michael Cimino movie, Year of the Dragon, starring Mickey Rourke, and they wanted no association between the two. Today, I'm very excited because I'm a holder and of one of this author's books, and actually all the way from the United States, my dear friend Jed Ayers recommended me this author and said, you really need to speak to Andrew Netty, man. You need to speak to him. He's an Aussie that I love and I'm a big fan of. And we've been sort of communicating for many years, trying to find the right projects. We missed each other after One Heat Minute. I've known for many years that he's a huge Michael Mann fan, but we now have an opportunity to talk Manhunter. Andrew, it's so nice to talk to you, man. Nice to meet you. Nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Oh, look, thank you for having me. It's an honor. I've wanted to do one of these. I wanted to do one of your man things for ages. And and I'm actually doing my favorite man. So it's Mindhunter. It's Mindhunter. Although I have to say, big fan of Year of the Dragon. Big fan of Year of the Dragon. So, could have happily done that.
You know what I say? Underrated. It's underrated. It's not that. It's not like I'd heard The Stink too. And The Great Folk, another great Australian institution, Imprint Films. Year of the Dragon was one of those films. I'd always heard about the Cimino stink, you know, Heaven's Gate, the guy who killed New Hollywood and all that sort of stuff. And I watched it and I was like, it's not great, but it's not awful. It's not a do not finish by any stretch of the imagination. Got some big ideas, got some huge set pieces, got some cool noir stuff. It's got some stuff, but here we are. We're at Manhunter, which is most important. And today, as we record this, so people are going to be hearing this much later. Today, the lovely folks at Screen Drafts have assembled a great team, Bilge Ibiri, Roxana Haddadi, and Brandon Straisnig, to all do a definitive Michael Mann ranking over at Screen Drafts coming up as well.
Controversial.
I can say all three of those people are guests on this show. So I approve of the resources that they've got there. And I trust the great Bilge Ibiri to keep things sane and keep Black Hat out of the top three. So very importantly, you said it was your favorite man. Can you talk to me about, I mean, you're a crime writer for folks who may not be aware, but why is this specific one your favorite man? Because I know you are a manhead.
Yeah, I think, that's a good question, because I thought about this a bit before coming on the show. I can't remember when I first saw this film, but I rewatched it when we first talked about me coming on the show a couple of months ago, maybe.
Yeah, a few months ago.
And I just had forgotten just what an absolute visual apocalypse this film is. I mean, there is so much in it that is so visually incredible. I think, I mean, and I'm not going to be the only person that says this. It's got the best Hannibal Lecter, hands down, I would say.
Yeah, it's. In the grand scheme of things, for a character, has some stiff competition on TV. My favorite working actor, Mads Mikkelsen, was so spectacular. Really love him. Hopkins is obviously iconic. Like Silence of the Lambs, you know. I think people think that for whatever silly reason, that if you love Manhunter, you can't also appreciate and love Silence of the Lambs. I'm like, it's a Jonathan Demme movie, my man. It's got, you know, Ted Levine in it. It's got Jodie Foster. It's got Anthony Hopkins. It's a revelation in the 90s. Like it kind of popularized, like it made the thriller genre, because it was not horror. It was a psychological thriller that Manhunter was really like trailblazing with. It, you know, made this thriller genre. It kind of elevated it to that next, that superior canonical level. But I have to agree, Cox is just doing something so wildly different than those other performances. And I think that people will hear from some of our guests on the show, or you may have already heard, it's just, there's just stuff that he does, Andrew, that like, if you research how serial killer interviews actually take place and how people feel when they're there,
which you have for the show,
we're both, you know, you read about it, it's like there's showboating and they're manipulative, and their body language is aggression, and he just does something there in an intimidation in this movie that I think is just so special.
He's the less is more Hannibal Lecter.
Yes.
I think, look, with all respect to Silence of the Lambs, which I like, and I've watched many times, and I watched most recently a couple of years ago with my daughter, introducing her to that. Isn't that really nice of me, introducing my daughter to
Silence of the Lambs? It's on the list for me too. Andrew.
Yeah, she loves those thrillers, but it made me realise how overwrought and overproduced and overhyped Hopkins, an actor I love, but how his version of Hannibal Lecter, whereas the Cox version is lean, mean, right. It really is. He's not angry. He's not. He's just so light touch, manipulative, and you know, it's got one of the best lines in a serial killer film, which is when, you know, so he says to Will Graham, "Well, then, how did you catch me?" And Graham says, "Well, you had disadvantages." And he says, "Such as, well, you're insane." You know, it's just, it's fantastic. So there's that, the look, the soundtrack, the whole package, and just a bravo performance of a cop, well, a former cop who gets pulled back into it, who's coming apart at the seams.
Yeah.
As he's getting drawn more and more into this, into trying to track down the Red Dragon, the serial killer. And I think virtually every performance is terrific. I would go so far as to say it's man's best film without it. And the look, the whole feel, the vibe, the 80s vibe, it all works for me. It all works big time for me. And every time I've watched it, I think I've watched it three times in preparation for this show, and I've liked it more and noticed things every single time.
Yeah, this is the thing, the one thing that we can share as Aussies. It's the one, there have been many man rep screenings in both our hometowns over the last 4 or 5 years. Heat's on every year, multiple theaters. Collateral, I'm sure, in its 20th anniversary year, will get a run. The Last of the Mohicans occasionally is on those runs, you know, a swashbuckling sensation of a movie. I've never seen Manhunter on a big screen.
No, you're quite right. And I mean, well, Heat and Last of the Mohicans and Collateral, they've all been on Netflix, so you could have just watched them on repeat if you wanted to. I mean,
of course.
Thief a bit less, and some of the other films a bit less. I mean, I think the only the well-known man film, I think, that doesn't get, probably the only one that gets less love, I think, than Manhunter. And I totally agree. I would love to see Manhunter on the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's The Keep.
Yeah.
Which is the one that we just don't, no one ever seems to really talk about. But
it's also because man doesn't really want to talk about it, because I think, yeah, you know, it's the heart. It would almost be, I don't know, for you as an author, you probably get this more than anyone. It's like, it would almost be like you wrote, if say you got a 20 chapter book, it'd be like you wrote sort of, you know, 16, 17 chapters, maybe some of them slightly out of order. You had to go in and flesh other bits out, and key chapters that you were saving till the end, someone just rewrote for you because they couldn't achieve what he wanted to achieve. Like, it was like someone else went in and tinkered and toiled away at special effects. Nothing ever worked. And I think for him, it always feels like a constant draft. And it's almost like that thing of like, man, can't we get some of that Snyder Cut money, throw it at Michael Mann, get some digital effects, get him to fix the digital effects in The Keep so he actually owns it. You know, we
It's a long time since I've seen The Keep. I think I watched that in a hostel during a sort of semi-tropical storm in Byron Bay, literally about 30 years ago. So, I mean, and I just remember thinking, well, this is pretty interesting, but then life moved
on. Can I just say that's the only way to watch it? So if you're not in a hostel in the middle of a tropical storm, you don't need to visit The Keep.
Well, they talk about the experience economy, you know.
Yeah.
we can't just look at it. Melbourne can't just play Wake in Fright. We have to get someone to redo the soundtrack and to add all this additional songs for $70. And I just think that's a bit silly, but that would be the experience economy, watching The Keep in a guest house in a tropical storm with a whole lot of Europeans in the background who really don't want to be watching it.
Absolutely. I think that that's perfect. We are now at the sixth scene. We've broken Manhunter not into equal, but certainly just into 24 component parts. There'll be more than 24 episodes in the series. This is the sixth episode. We're at the scene immediately after the Atlanta office, seeing the police and the profilers discuss everything about the letter from the Tooth Fairy, or the Great Red Dragon, as we'll come to know him, to Lecter, and making sure that they're trying to take it out of Lecter's cell to find out exactly what was written on it in order for them to do their thing. It's only a couple of minutes scene, the one that we're doing right now, just like the previous scene, leading into the Lecter scene. So we're going to start it now. It's in the theatrical.
Can I just say, how good is that scene in the Atlanta police headquarters this group of cops who are just intensely uncomfortable with this whole serial killer thing, and these serial killer profilers who are like, oh, these cops, they're absolutely hopeless. And that's such a good scene.
It's magnificent. And it has Dennis Farina's, I've actually screenshotted a Dennis Farina's disapproving face. So yes, you may see me deploy it when someone says something so stupid. You might just see me react with a quote tweet with Dennis Farina's face, looking at these, like looking at that tweet, like, God, what a waste of space. Great scene. And also not just your typical information exposition exercise, a scene that's blocked within an inch of its life, composed with bodies, the way that the guys are framed, the way that certain characters are hunched, the colors. My God, it's sensational. It's just so, so, so beautiful.
And it's also when Graham first, it's not my scene, but it's also when Graham
You're
first.
You're allowed, cheap. Let's do it.
Yeah. It's also when Graham first starts to posit the idea of the dragon's dreams.
Yes.
As being crucial to catching this guy, and the cops just go, "Oh, get me the hell out of here! Who is this freak? Who is this freak? This is so I don't want to have to deal with this." You know,
it's really excellent. You know, you're so right. It's like when he starts saying stuff like that, it reminds me of one of my favorite scenes in TV in True Detective, when Woody Harrelson's character Marty looks at Rust and Cole and he's like, "Can you stop saying weird shit?"
Yes.
Great scene. Yeah. Don't say things like smell the psychosphere. That like yeah. that just tells me 100% that that
absolutely.
Anyone who made that show is a fan of Manhunter. So
yeah.
So let's go into our scene. It's 21 minutes 34 33 seconds into the film. So if you're queuing up the theatrical cut, Andrew and I are going to start watching now, and then we're just going to unpack this. Like I've said on previous episodes, this is very much a Roger Ebert cinema interruptus style where we're going to watch the scene together. We're going to pause it. We're going to take it back. We're going to go forward, back, forward, back. So if you guys are watching this and you're my patrons and you're watching it on our Patreon, you'll probably see Andrew and I talk it back. You'll see what we're looking at. But for those of you, you're just going to have to use your imagination. You're going to have to recover the mindset and just think about Manhunter, and hopefully you'll be inspired to watch if you're not watching and you're just listening. All right, so here we go.
I got a partial print with a tented arch. It's probably a thumb. And the fragment of a palm off the nail of Mrs. Leeds' left big toe. Thumbprint came off the oldest kid's left eye. It stood out against an eight-ball hemorrhage from the gunshot wound.
Can we make an identification off of it?
Maybe, if he's ever been printed and he's in my index. I want to work these up in my own dark room. I'll fax the prints down to you this afternoon.
Thanks.
And there it is. There it is. Look at that. Yeah, look at that. The Farina kind of, oh, your fingerprint is... Your fingerprint is a crap. You guys are crap. You know, I've busted you big time.
Love him. God, yeah, what a king. Yeah. Such a sensation. Yeah, yeah. All right. So, folks, here we go. I'm going to actually leave that in. I'm not editing that out. Andrew got a little bit of his favorite scene. Just the.
One of my many favorite scenes. But yeah.
Here we go. Can we just say for a second, Stephen Lang right now, for many people, is for a certain generation, it's the scary old blind guy from Don't Breathe. From some people, it's simply Avatar. I mean, again, both movies have made, I think, a collective amount of like something in the realm of $4 billion at the box office. So huge pop cultural resonances, impossible to deny at this point. But back then, but also,
I think so this was 86 that year too. No, actually you're right, because 89 I was looking into him. He played the gay trade unionist in Last Exit to Brooklyn.
That's it.
Which is fantastic, but the scene that I really remember him in was, and again, the party crasher in 1991's The Hard Way. I'm a big fan of that film. I know
I've seen that movie in decades.
No great shakes of any kind of film. the Michael J. Fox, what's his name? The lead character who I was just talking about the other day, who I can't remember, you know, James Woods character.
Yeah, James Woods.
Fantastic. And I also, just with this scene too, I just love in the top left-hand corner, just that black female cop just sort of hanging out. I'm not quite sure what she's doing. She's just sort of, she's sitting on the railing, just hanging out. But anyway,
sitting on the railing, looking at the chaos, great 80s haircuts. Sunglasses pairings, leather jackets.
Stephen Lang,
he's so fresh-faced. He's all curly-haired, cocksure, and confident. He's also excellent in Michael Mann's Public Enemies. If you have not seen that, you must do
so. I have seen that a long time ago, yes. Well, when it came out.
He's really excellent, much more grizzled and tough, but he's just a lot. You love this, that for one of the first times, we don't stick with Will and Jack. Debriefing on the chaos that's just unfolded, we get Freddie Lowndes.
Print where it. If Jimmy can find him in the index, and if he's ever been printed.
What do you hear? What do you say? You remember me? Freddie Lowndes?
Such a sleaze.
He's an absolute... What do you hear? What do you say?
In his two-tone suit.
Yeah. Two-tone suit, stripes.
Yeah. Just looking like a sleaze bag. And completely unafraid of these two cops, one of whom is basically a walking time bomb.
Yeah, and also, do you remember me? We're going to get to it in a moment, Andrew, but do you remember me? Do you think that you could forget someone who broke into your hospital room and took photos of you after you had been essentially an attempted gutting had happened to you. Like, this is not a guy.
By that psychopathic killer. That's right.
Yeah, but
right.
And that it's not exactly a guy you forget. So he's just, again, the bluster, the shit-eating grin. He's just so fantastic here. I love him. It's 21 minutes, 55 seconds if you want to pause it, if you're not watching with us. But just he's just got this great little, this little something. He's antagonistic, and it's great.
And his 80s new wave haircut, too.
Oh, huge new wave vibes on the hair. It's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, when did they call you? What do you got? Hey, look, I'm buying lunch.
Hey, right? Lounge, why don't you give it a rest?
Hey, he's news. I'm doing my job.
I've never also seen, just really quickly here, you've got Farina who says to him, I'm just going to get it back to this moment. I'll just play it while we're talking. The fact that, like, Jack is usually the protector, he's intimidating. In a lot of these scenes, he's so tall. You get this Lounge moment where he's like, you know, they're talking about the print in the background. You guys can hear it too. And, hey, what do you see? What do you know? He's trying to get in his face. And I just love, he's not scared of Jack, Andrew. That's what
gets me. No, he's not.
Give it a rest.
And I love that. I love that too. He did the paperback.
Yeah, I did the
calling paperback. It back to those great days, which I only just noticed that tonight, actually, when I was just looking at this scene again before the show. Those days when a true crime scuzzbag tabloid, true crime journalist would cover the case and then produce one of those really lurid 1970s, 80s mass market Insta paperbacks on the case.
Which is essentially just a massive series of bloated articles that are completely unedited.
Exactly. That's right.
With lots more personal...
And some black and white pictures.
Black and white pictures and
lots. But
more.
A great cover. Probably a great nasty cover, you know, with a sort of... A black and white photograph and a grave or something like that.
Hatching Hannibal the Cannibal or something.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And so he pushes him, but he just doesn't care. I love it. It's like 22 minutes and 2 seconds.
Hey, he's news. I'm doing my job.
He's news. I'm doing my job. I just love. He just pushes him away.
What does he do to him? How's he doing? How's he doing, Will?
Pushing. 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 Pushing.
The one bit, it's 22 minutes, 11 seconds, when he postures and gets in
front
of him.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right.
There is a flash. I just want folks to register, if you can, because Andrew and I caught it, and we've caught it because we've watched it a million times. But if you watch it, there's this flash where all the bluster in like a split second disappears. And we've paused this on 22 minutes, 11 seconds, and there's fear in his eyes because Will just grabs him by the throat around his tie. And we're about to see Lounge just get tossed because it's like you imagine. This is the other thing I wonder also for the mental health of journalists, right? Like you're an author. I'm friends with many journalists and things like that. It's like when you're an antagonistic shitbag and you play the heel all the time, like you have to put yourself in these situations to break news. And like if the Tatler is a tabloid, it's a rag. But it's in this moment that he's just like, it's all for the game. It's all for the game. It's all for the story. He's news. I'm going after him. But you have to expect sometimes that people are going to hurt you, I suppose.
Well, it's interesting because I assume that as part of your research for this, you would have read the book Thomas Harris's Red Dragon.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, of course. You probably got it there.
I do. Right. I've got a better. This is the paperback, which is the terrible Brett Ratner poster Red Dragon, which is bad.
I should have had mine out.
I've got that at least. But I actually have a couple of copies of this paperback. It's truly, the book is such a phenomenal read for anyone.
It's got Lourdes' backstory, which I think is really interesting, and the fact that he used to be a mainstream news journalist. So he was a real journalist.
Yes.
And then he just realized, I'm never going to get anywhere doing this. And he went over to the tabloids and made much more money. So it's interesting because he combines that sleazy tabloid sensibility with the fact that he's actually he used to be a real journalist. So he knows how it works, you know, and he knows the tricks and he's not scared, obviously, of anyone.
And the great thing about Lounge, and they kind of explore it a little bit in the Hannibal TV series, is that when Lounge starts out and is the Tatler that exists in that universe, it isn't as lurid and as tabloidy as you expect. It gets increasingly worse because the content, right? If you're covering a serial killer that's named Hannibal, it's like, oh, I've got a headline. It's called Hannibal the Cannibal. It's like the serial killer's around. They've got characters. They start, you know, start being the architect of all this, like, you know, spin. But yeah, I think it,
Who plays him on the TV show?
It's a woman. It's still Freddie Lowndes. But let me go to Hannibal, the series.
Which I must admit I haven't seen, so I can't comment on that.
I would say, Andrew, it's really good. Lara Jean Kurostecki plays Freddie Lowndes in show for some reason. She's a Canadian actress. She's absolutely terrific. I'm trying to see if she hasn't been in too many big films, a lot more TV, but she was for a couple of years there at the peak of the Hannibal TV series. She was in the show and played Freddie Lowndes, striking red hair, really terrific actor. And but I think they play more on the Red Dragon backstory in that she's like, she's not an awful tabloid freak right at the beginning, but she has a relationship with Will Graham where she's a normal kind of journalist and now the dark side. And so see here, the inference I think we get right away is that he's a bit of a shit, but also man isn't cruel enough, I don't think, as we're going to see later in the movie, to not empathize with him when he gets into a bit of a dangerous situation with one Francis Dollarhide. So I think that's
I think I must have been put off seeing the television series because I intensely disliked the 2002 Red Dragon film.
Oh, it's bad.
I mean, and in fact, it's in the very small Parthenon of about four films I think I've walked out of a cinema on. It's up there with Air Force One and a couple of other films that I basically got 20, 30 minutes into and just thought, this is ridiculous. I'm not finished.
It's the old DNF. And but, I would just say that, and I admire greatly Steven Soderbergh puts out a yearly movie, TV, music watch list every year. It's like must subscribe to, listen to, watch. And he does actually say sometimes where he only watches half of something. I think it's his just kind way of like, I didn't finish it. You never know whether he hated it or whether he was just too busy. But I'm with you, Andrew. There are so many folks that I know, and even sort of in a frustrating way, talking to one of my friends, Stu Coote, to kick off the series, he was joking that he really enjoys Red Dragon. And I'm just like, even as a person who loves the book Red Dragon, and maybe in some ways that adaptation from Ted Talley is, you know, slightly in a couple of details more faithful to the original adaptation, it's like it has Anthony Hopkins, it has Harvey Keitel, it has Philip Seymour Hoffman, it has Ted Talley as the screenwriter, it has one of my favorite cinematographers, the same one who did this movie, Dante Spinotti. It has all the ingredients to be a fantastic movie, and just like, hey, fine, make it again. Who cares? The movie's one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. It's god awful. It is intolerable to watch. And it is, and I watched it recently around doing this. You know, I was like, okay, am I being that person who didn't give it a fair shake because I do have an obsession with Michael Mann films, and I'm not wrong. I'm rarely wrong on that.
It's also like this film, Manhunter, is actually a very low key film.
Yes.
Until the last 10 minutes when all hell breaks loose, when, you know, there's the shootout with Dollarhide. It's actually a very low key film. And I think it's all the better for being that low key film. Whereas the Red Dragon film is so gory and nasty. And I think I walked out when Anthony Hopkins was eating Ray Liotta's or was having the dinner party with the sort of semi-lobotomized
Thinking Hannibal. You're thinking Hannibal.
Am I thinking Hannibal?
No.
Gosh, I'm terribly sorry. I'm thinking Hannibal.
But that's that okay.
Film I walked out of. Sorry.
That's okay. Don't watch Red Dragon. It is actually just as bad. Right. It's at least Hannibal, I can absolutely tolerate because It's unwieldy and chaotic, but Ridley Scott is making a universal monster movie where Hannibal is the monster. And that is insane. It's one of the most insane endings of any movie ever. But I kind of respect Ridley for being like full wacko, sicko Ridley in that. But Red Dragon is just excellent.
I'm sorry about that. Yes, it's Hannibal that was the one I walked out of, not Red Dragon.
You don't have to apologize. I'm glad that you didn't have to even see Red Dragon to walk out of it.
There you go.
I would prefer that. So we've got Stephen Lang, his scrunched up face being crushed by Will Graham here. Let's kick this off and see what the consequences of being too aggressive a journalist is to one Will Graham. A man, as you said so beautifully, like falling apart at the seams.
Keep the fuck away from me.
Will.
Love that. What a fantastic reaction. Just tosses him on, keep the fuck away from me. And it's one of the first times, again, you see Will's physical strength. He's been such a demure guy. We haven't seen anything really rattle him. He's seen some awful stuff so far. And then it's just like, get the fuck away from me. And then right now we get this beautiful cut to, you know, this elevated rail, the train, we're about to see them. I love how forceful Jack Crawford has to be to drag Will off him there, Andrew. I love it. I can't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm. Some bitch snuck into the hospital. I was sedated after lecture. He pulled back the sheets and he took pictures.
Yeah, I know.
Look, don't expect too much from me, all right?
We only got 3 weeks left and you're our best shot.
What do you think? I'm going to see him stand in the street and say, there he is? That's Houdini you're thinking about.
This is the first time in the film too where you actually start to see that A, Graham is starting to fall apart.
Yes.
And B, like, this is really hard. What are we going to do? We've got no leads. What's going to happen? But how tightly wound is Graham? And he knows he's into it, but he's also he doesn't like it. He's fighting it. He likes it. You know, he's this mess. He's this complete mess, and he's starting to sort of come apart at the seams a bit.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that I just noticed is like it's the way that the camera whips around and Will kind of like does this, you know, throat first judo throw onto a car and just smashes a windscreen with this guy and goes, stay the fuck away from me, and comes back here. This is the first time that the camera mirrors the chaos that we're about to see with Will, because, you know, this is the scene that leads into the famous lecture scene. Which at the end of that scene, he's tearing apart at the seams. He's really, you know, running through that facility, and the camera is moving across like a person watching a tennis ball at a tennis match, you know. And here you've got this amazing dance. It's this handheld revolving two shot of Will and Jack, just like so handheld, so shaky without being sort of like distracting, spinning around. Yeah. And you can just tell it's like, there is something that's going on here. And as you said, it's the first time that Will breaks. In all the other scenes, he's very chill.
And I think the other thing I know, see, the other thing I just, again, you notice bits and pieces. The thing I noticed on this most recent viewing, which was earlier today, I just thought I'd give it one more quick look before I came on today, is, and I was trying to remember, was William Peterson always that great? Is that makeup or was he actually great? Because, I mean, the guy looks old. The guy looks old before his time. He looks – that's part of, I think, what works really well is that he looks old and beaten up and traumatized, and he's not some gorgeous, really healthy cop. The guy's been through the ringer, obviously.
Yes.
And you can really see it in the film. This particular freeze here, which is, what, 22:42, he looks like shit.
Yeah,
he's only in his 30s. So, you know, he looks like crap.
He's getting the wings. He's getting the gray wings. He's in his probably mid 30s in this scene. He's getting the gray wings on his hair. His hair's curly,
right,
kind of light.
Right.
It's not so dark, but yeah, he's definitely graying early. And I don't know if they like helped that along. I've noticed on the side of my beard, you can't really see it with my headphones, but on the side of my beard and the side of my hair, if it grows out, I've got those gray wings. I feel those lines underneath my eyes, but it's in that moment also. It's like half putting a cigarette in is like, what do you want me to do? Point him out in the street? Like, we're doing everything that we can as quickly as we can. And that's exactly the desperation that leads to this next play, which is just so fantastic in the last 30 seconds here. But I can't get enough. I'm just going to take it back just a fraction because I really want to watch this camera move because you've got this really static shot. And then Jack does the Yano.
Look, don't expect too much from me, all right?
We only got 3 weeks left and you're our best shot.
What do you think? I'm going to see him stand in the street and say, there he is? That's Houdini you're thinking about.
Same camera move.
The Tooth Fairy's going to go on until we get smart or we get lucky. He won't stop.
Why?
He's got a genuine taste for it.
Oh, yeah. That's a great line. He's got a taste for it. You know, he likes it.
Yeah. Before, and I love the turn of phrase, there are so many matter of fact things that also like almost like create the archetype for what a hell of a lot of crime genre does after this. But there's something so matter of fact of like, he's got a genuine taste for it. Like obviously he's the Tooth Fairy, obviously, but just that line, the way that he says it, he's got a genuine taste for it. Like he's...
Clarice Starling says a similar thing in Silence of the Lambs. I was just looking at Peterson in the film he did in 1985, 1 year before Manhunter, To Live and Die in L.A., which is also a terrific film. His hair's quite black. So obviously, man had him make-upped up to look that disheveled, which works, which is great. Because he does, as I said before, he looks like complete freeze-dried shit. He just looks terrible. And it gets worse and worse as he gets dragged in further and further.
He looks fantastic in Florida on the Floridian beach. He looks great. The sun's hitting his hair. It looks more like it's blonde highlights than gray. But in this cold gray exterior, very industrial exterior, he does. I love. He looks like.
And I think that's an interesting question. That's an interesting thing you said. And I didn't have time to really dig into this because I was looking at. This is not obviously the first serial killer film. I mean, there are serial killer films that go right back to Fritz Lang's M and actually arguably even before that. But this is the first one, just in a very quick perusal, and someone can correct me on this, which involves the trope of the cop, the sort of cop hunting the serial killer, and they're in some respects two sides of the same coin. You know, I would be hard pressed to think of a film that sort of deals that has that trope, which this film has pre this. That really, it's set, as you say, so much of the template for these kind of films, which are now a dime a dozen. You know?
Yeah, it's where Manhunter has the edge contemporarily. I think the first serial killer film, I'm just looking at some articles here. This one, particularly from the AV Club, said that there was a 7-minute Portuguese film in 1909 called The Crimes of Diego Alves, which is a 19th century criminal who that was like 22 years before Fritz Lang's M. So you were spot on there. And then there's another one from 1920s. It's a vampire tale where there's sort of a serial killer. And I would say then there's like a raft of Jack the Ripper films, which we get, which is sort of like, you know, a classical idea of like a multiple murderer. But I think where Manhunter comes on like on the razor's edge of contemporary thought, it's the first time where behavioral science and criminal profiling is actually hitting the mainstream. And it almost hits at that exact perfect time where it's like it is so steeped in popular culture and it's like just been published, but it's kind of been simmering away. It's what David Fincher's Mindhunter series, which is terrific and is on Netflix, is all about, is like the birth of, you know, behavioral science. And it's happens right now, and it starts to really interrogate the question of like, what would the psychological toll be on someone who has to go and look at all these heinous things and try and study them and decode them? And what's the mindset that you've got to be in? And that's, you know, typical of this scene that we're about to watch, is like, you know, how do you stay there in this?
Well, that's the, except for the, except I would, I mean, look, I mean, a really thorough forensic dive would, a deep dive into this subject would probably no doubt unearth a few gems. But except for the last 5 minutes of Psycho in 1960, where there's that sort of weird psycho babble where they're trying to explain why Norman Bates is like he is. I think that's what you're saying is probably pretty much on the money. And I think that it's what hunting a serial killer does to someone, but it's also that a trope which has become very popular, which is I have to get into the serial killer's mind, and in some respects, yes, I have to be as fucked up as they are to basically think of what they were doing. And I mean, you mentioned that excellent, I thought, Netflix show Mindhunter, which I loved.
Yes.
And that was based on a guy called John E. Douglas. Well, one of the characters was based on a guy called John E. Douglas, I think, who was one of the FBI's original serial killer profilers. And I would argue very strongly that he's also the basis of this character of Peterson's character.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're spot on. It's there was a piece of news about Mindhunter series 3, and
don't taunt me, don't get my hopes up,
this is no hope. I just want to say there's no hope. They're just saying that so fellow Aussie Andrew Dominic was like, season 3 was going to be about behavioral science in Hollywood.
Man.
So one of them was going to be hooking up with Jonathan Demme for Silence of the Lambs and hooking up with Michael Mann. So this is, you know, our fellow Aussie was told at this stage, I believe it was, I'm just going to see where the actual original interview, because I've got sort of he did an interview with Collider, internet movie site, where he said that they were thinking of doing season 3, and it was where basically they've become popularized, like behavioral science has kicked off and now Hollywood wants a piece, and they were going to sort of have those interactions and see how those guys interacted here. But I would absolutely say you're spot on. It's like at that time, John Douglas, the whole behavioral science thing, it's, you know, And even Thomas Harris's Red Dragon was straight out of that. It was inspired
totally.
As well. So, and yeah, also, I think it's that confluence of events. Absolutely. They're all just on that track.
And the other great thing about Mindhunter, which is, can't say, it's full of scenes where local law enforcement are just going, Who the fuck are these weirdos? You know, they're coming in, they're weird, they're creepy, we don't like them. Can they just go away?
And it's the Mindhunter has that great Mindhunter season 2 has that incredible series of the Atlanta child murders, yes, where they're trying
happening about the same time, happening just a few years after this film is set.
Yeah, happening around that time, and the scary thing about that was, like, you know, people not fitting the profile. There were, you know, there were that there were later documentaries about, there were multiple killers working together all inside their own racial lines, etc. Very creepy stuff. But according to at least the proposed, what we can imagine for a season 3 of Mindhunter is that Michael Mann would have appeared as a character. And my God, yeah, I would give any amount of money to see that series come to life, just to see who they cast as Michael Mann in the early 80s, you know, asking all these questions and busting Holden Ford's balls about Will Graham and those sorts of things. I would love to see that. All right, let's dive back into our scene.
You do know something about him.
Not enough. I'll go see Lecter now.
Why?
Recover the mindset.
We got to go back a second. We have to go back.
That's a key line.
We've got to go back. We've got to go back.
Street and say, there he is. That's Houdini you're thinking about.
The Tooth Fairy's going to go on until we get smart or we get lucky. He won't stop.
Why?
He's got a genuine taste for it.
There's this brief moment of malaise. We've talked about it. He's freaking out. You know, we see the stakes. He's got a genuine taste for it. And you got to love Crawford here.
You do know something about him.
You do know something about him.
Not enough.
Yeah, maybe. Not yeah,
not enough. Yeah, well, that's debatable, Will.
I've got my own weird fucked up theory, but I'm not going to share that with you yet. You know?
Not going to share it completely with you yet.
Yeah.
And then this is the, you know, we've obviously just seen Will's reaction to Freddie Lowndes, I guess, being a stark reminder of the Lecter factor that's sort of haunting the beginning of this film. You know, we're 20 minutes in. I know you as a storyteller must think of this. The economy of storytelling in cinema is everything to me. Like TV series, there are so few that are genuinely fantastic and feel essential for every minute of their runtime. So many series, you know, if it's an 8-episode series, it should have been 6. If it's a 20-episode series, it should have been 8. If it's 5 seasons, it should be 3. You know, there's so many series that feel so bloated and overstuffed and have no resolution and feel like they're just stretching butter over too much bread just to keep viewers. And here we're 23 minutes in. We're 22 minutes and 58 seconds. We're looking at Will look down and you do know something about him before he's thinking. He's just taking that away before he comes back. But we know that he's just had this chaotic reaction to seeing Freddie Lowndes, the guy who photographed him after everything that happened with Lecter. And then he says this line.
I think I'll go see Lecter tomorrow.
Why?
Recover the mindset.
Recover the mindset.
Jack's face here, Andrew, is everything. Because he goes, why? He's concerned. It's like, why? Like,
it's interesting too, Farina here again. Farina's someone who you could really do a deep dive into. He's done so much stuff.
Done everything.
Most of what he's seen, very rarely have I ever seen him be the straight man.
Yeah.
You know, so, and he plays a good straight man in this one. He's tough and he's good and he's, you know, I think my dominant impression of Farina is when he played Jennifer Lopez's father in Out of Sight. But you know, he doesn't play the straight man very often and he is the straight man.
And when he asks Keaton's character, do they all give you a shirt? Do they give everyone that shirt?
That's right. That's
such
right,
a ball buster.
Right.
Keaton
doesn't know whether it's a joke or not. So yeah.
Ray Nicola, great scene, great movie, great performance.
Yeah.
No, I agree. This is early in his career. This is really where he shines. And I think that it's kind of this, and then Marty Brest sees something in him, The Midnight Run. And I think that for so much more of his career post Midnight Run, it was like, we need Farina in that mode because of how essential that was. But he's got a quiet care in this moment, the concern, the furrow on his brow. This is 23 minutes, 10 seconds. We're nearly done our scene. And we're almost at the conclusion, basically. But that fact that Will says to him, I think I'll go see Lecter tomorrow. And it's like, why? Like, it does not compute. And for so much of the time, it's usually the cops that are going, what the hell are these guys on about? But in this moment, the decision to do that, Farina is like, why would you want to do that? Recover the mindset. Oh man, what a line. What a line. And he's still baffled. Sensational stuff. Let's watch it again. It was so good.
What do you think? I'm going to see him stand in the street and say, there he is? That's Houdini you're thinking about. The Tooth Fairy's going to go on until we get smart or we get lucky. He won't stop.
Why?
He's got a genuine taste for it.
You do know something about him.
Not enough. I think I'll go see Lecter tomorrow.
Why?
Recover the mindset.
What a moment. So good.
Mm-hmm. Actually, an interesting... I mean, when you think about it, look, watching this scene... An important bridging scene in the film. A lot of stuff comes out actually now when we watched it together and you've slowed it down and we've replayed it. I realize There's a lot in this scene. It's a bridging scene between the cops in the Atlanta station. He's going to have a conversation with his wife, and then the crucial scene that everyone wants to do, which is the scene with Cox as Lecter. But really sets some very key markers in the film, this one, I think. You know, we see that what's his name? We see that William Peterson, Graham, is starting to come apart. He's also got an idea about what he wants to do. He's got an idea about the case. There's that whole relationship set up with the sleazy journalist. And also there's the key line, which you've just played again, which is just, I need to go and recover the scent. I'm going to go and see my biggest fear, the guy who shanked me and then basically, nearly killed me and put me in a, what would be the polite way of putting it, put me in mental health care for some considerable time and nearly just destroyed my entire life. I'm going to go back and see him because I need to recover the scent.
And one major thing that happens, and we haven't had to talk about really much of it so far in the series, but one major, major difference in the director's cut is an addendum to this scene that Mann puts back in, which is Will is talking to Molly more throughout the director's cut than he does in the theatrical cut.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the scene where he talks to Molly and she says to him, like, I love you and I miss you and you're doing the right thing, is that little bit of fuel in his fire that kind of allows him to push and bridge into this Lecter scene and brace himself. Whereas in the theatrical cut, and I don't know which one I prefer, probably the theatrical, just because I've seen it more times, even though some parts of the director's cut, particularly towards the ending, are so disturbing and fantastic, which I love. But in this particular moment, I love how stark the contrast is between I'll go see Lecter tomorrow and then we're right there. Whereas in the director's cut, it's like Will then has to go stew on the decision to go see Lecter and be isolated again for X amount of hours and wait, because again, it's the waiting game and the hurry up and wait of it all. But that's the other major difference that we're not going to cover today. But yeah, it's a really ripper of a scene. And it's just one more where Molly just shows how essential she is to Will, because in this, Jack should be holding him together. He's trying. And sometimes he needs Molly as well. And they're both trying. And by the end of the movie, he's breaking apart and no one can really hold him together. But particularly that's the only other difference in the director's cut, in case anyone was wondering. And in case you're watching along and doing the director's cut with us as we're doing this.
Well, the other important thing about that conversation is he's hiding from Molly just how badly he's getting sucked in. And she picks up, she says, I know this is taking a lot out of you, but I don't think how can she? She doesn't quite realize just what's happening. Because he actually says in that scene, he says, look, I'm going away. I'm taking a trip tomorrow. Or I can't remember what he says exactly, but he says, I'm taking a trip. And she says, oh, where are you going? And he just goes, oh, I just got to go do something.
Yeah. He doesn't want to tell her where. He doesn't tell her he's going to Lecter.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's like, I love you. I miss you. You're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Andrew. Man alive, it has been too long. What a pleasure it's been talking to you. See how much fun we can have when we tear something apart and
absolutely,
put it all back together.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What a ball. Well, it's been a real treat.
A film that's this texturally rich.
Yes.
I mean, gosh, absolutely.
What a great scene. This has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. Is the best place for me to direct folks to your website, popcurry.com, to find all your stuff?
No. Pop Curry is kind of in abeyance. You can go to my Substack.
Substack, great.
My Substack, which is, you can just search Andrew Netty Substack, where I talk about pulp culture and noir once every 2 weeks. Well, roughly once every 2 weeks. that's what I do.
All right, excellent. I'll make sure it's linked in the show notes. Thank you so much. This has been a real treat, man. Thank you so much. It's been way overdue, but I'm so glad that we got to talk about your favorite Man film, and it's been just a treat unpacking it with you and seeing inside your brain. It's great. Thank you so much for
Can I just ask, do you reckon you might eventually get to Last of the Mohicans?
I've done Mohicans.
You've done Mohicans, have
yeah,
you? Yeah. Mohicans. Oh my God.
We did 12 episodes. It was called The Last. You've got to go back.
I'm going to have to get back into that.
We did a special episode. Thank you for reminding me, because sometimes folks often ask, like, what series have we covered? Because Katie Walsh and I do Miami Nice, which is now, I would just broadly say, is a sprawling modern man discussion. We've talked Ferrari with Michael Mann himself and one of the stars. We've talked Collateral Confessions with, a whole bevy of wonderful people, including writer Stuart Beattie. But we did a brief series on The Last of the Mohicans, which I called The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, because I think it's maybe the best 12 minutes ever in any movie ever made, and just talked about that scene. So I do have it there sitting on One Heat Minute Productions. It's in our completed podcast if you want to go back and listen. But
I will.
Any other time, let's book another time, maybe later in the year, once Manhunter series is finished, you and I can get back together and do a special episode on Mohicans, on that last 12 minutes, or any of your other favorites.
Have you done one thieving minute about Thief?
We did a little.
I know you did a little bit about that, but I don't think you've done
It wasn't as in depth. That one was more at the passing of Jimmy Caan. We did a couple of special episodes on Thief, particularly because I was lucky enough to speak to Jim Belushi and a few other folks who really love that movie, and just sort of did a bit of a oral remembrance. So that was sort of like a bonus, but haven't done the deep dive yet on Thief. But Manhunter for me was one that, as I think you said it right at the beginning, Andrew, you said like, it's one of your faves. You've watched it many times, but every time you go back to it, especially after you've had a little bit of a break from it, you're shocked at just how amazing it is. And so
I
was so keen to get back to Manhunter, but the keep's still on the table. That's untouched. The Insider, lots of people keep talking to me about doing The Insider. And I say to folks, that was the main reason I did all the President's Minutes instead of The Insider, because it was like I wanted to do a journalism movie without talking about The Insider. So I went to the other greatest journalism movie ever made. There's a few that are left on the table. But at some point down the track, I mean, especially doing the show in the way that we're doing it now, we're having such a ball just pouring over things and unpacking it in this way. I can't see a world where I leave something on the table forever with Michael Mann.
With Mohicans too. I mean, that scene where the Mohicans attack the retreating British soldiers.
Oh yeah.
Still one of the greatest action scenes that man's done. I think that is just extraordinary. I love that scene.
Unbelievable scene. Like the whole movie is fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a big fan of the film.
Another great one, another rousing one. But yeah, I think that last 12 minutes, particularly, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're watching the director's or the theatrical cut, the last 12 minutes of that movie, I think from the moment that, from the moment that Cora and Alice are released to Magua and Duncan sacrifices himself, from that moment on, as all that unfolds all the way to the conclusion, the movie is as good a use of cinematic montage as any movie has ever done, and music. It's unbelievable. It's perfect. It's threaded to my heart. I love it to pieces. Thank you again.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed this. And thank you for getting me to rewatch this film after a long time and just going, wow, this is amazing. This really is amazing.
And thank you for tweeting about it and blowing your replies into oblivion. Blowing your notifications into oblivion. So bless you. Thank you so much. This has been an episode of Manhunter, the latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I, and all modern man movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there. And the Jimmy Kahn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon / One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron, for as little as $1 a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Min Hunter episode, Min Hunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.